place is different. Special. The others don't want to talk about it because it scares them. But we all know it. We all feel it. Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast. My name is Dave, and you could call me Cave Dave because I would go straight to live in those caves.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and you can call me Beach Joanna because there's no way I'm going to the caves because they're cooler than bees.
And I'm Neil Miller, and you can call me Mr. 1000% because that is the percentage chance that I would be in the caves.
Why would you go to the cave when you would stay on the beach and have some schmuck do-gooder in the cave lug water to the beach for you? Because you know they will.
Everybody knows that Joannas like to be by the beach so they could just have a swim whenever they feel like it.
Doesn't look like a riptide from here.
I bet I'm a strong swimmer. I could pull this off. I don't want to go further inland. Hiking is not my main skill. We're here to talk about House of the Rising Sun, episode 6 of season 1 of Lost. We are a Lost rewatch podcast. We split the episode into two sections. One we call The Calm, which is just for those of you rewatching Lost for the first time, and only want to talk about the episodes that we have watched up to now. That will be up through the episode House of the Rising Sun, which is episode 6. That counts the pilot as two episodes. Then, if you like spoilers and you're maybe rewatching Lost or don't care and want to hear some things that probably won't make sense but might be able to help you into some foreshadowing for future episodes, I guess, that's for The Storm on the back half of our podcast. If you look at your podcast app, you will see a time code for when The Storm begins. We encourage you to press pause and maybe come back later if that's your jam. Then you get twice the rewatch podcast for the one rewatch. Anyway, that's not important. Joanna, how's our Lost experiment been going since we used to be a Game of Thrones podcast with our reviews?
Ooh, it's a mixed bag, Dave. Thanks for asking. We've got some great reviews, and thank you so much for those. And then I will read one negative review. So this one says 5 stars, great stuff from Kyle Dave 4189 or Kyle Dav 4189. After listening to these three dissect Game of Thrones, I could not have imagined a better trio to tackle the mythology, character beats, and production process / lore of a show as complex as Lost. But this past week, they went and topped themselves by adding Kim Renfro to the mix and forcing me to look inside myself and examine why Kim and I are Jack Shepard / Jon Snow trash people. I would give the first several episodes a 5 and give this episode a 6 if I could. I hope they find a way to incorporate Mallory, Jason, Dave, and Richard into the mix at some point as well. So that is 5 stars for us and as well as Kim Renfro. All right. And then we got a 1-star review, like a crutch, like word, FD25. I've enjoyed the content and general vibe of this Lost Rewatch podcast, but I have one suggestion. Joanna uses the word like so much that it makes the podcast a difficult listen. I hope you will view this as constructive. We all have vocal crutches, and the only way to fix them is to be aware of them. I think if you listen back to an episode, you'll be shocked at the repeated use of like. Cheers. This is not new information to me, but thank you for sharing it. So you can leave a review for us on iTunes. We greatly appreciate it. As Dave always says, if you leave 5 stars, you can say anything you want. That is our preference. Leave us 5 stars and then make fun of all my verbal crutches. And we will leave with a smile on our face.
Yay! Those are our reviews. We almost left with a smile on our face, but we started with a smile on our face. And this episode is just so darn good then let's just keep it on despite all the haters. Neil, it's time to pick up some signals from our listeners in your section, which we are still calling Found Signals.
Yeah, until we find something better, which we may not. But anyway, we've found a few email signals, and I'm going to be honest, it's more positivity because that's what I like, and this is my section. The first one up is an email from Kate, although I'm told not Kate from the island. Kate says, I followed Joanna here from a cast of Kings, and I'm so glad that I did. Lost was the first show I was ever emotionally invested in. When Lost started, I was 13 years old, and I vividly remember sitting on my couch, anxiously awaiting for the premiere to start for this show that looks so exciting and interesting. From that day forward, I was hooked, and I never missed an episode throughout my teenagerhood. Being that I was 13, I wasn't fully immersed in the internet culture, so all of my theorizing was done in person. I cannot wait for science class the day after an episode to discuss with my friend Aaron what the hell was going on and what we thought would happen next. This show is so nostalgic for me and was so important to me when I was a young person. I can't wait to watch it again from an adult's perspective. Thank you so much for giving me a reason to return to this mysterious, magical island. I would like to say that I agree with Kate. I did not watch this in my teens. It was more in my 20s, but I was quite different in my 20s. So I'm excited to be a more mature human rewatching Lost. Full stop. Next email comes from Paula in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Shout out to Brazil. Paula says, I've been listening to Storm of Spoilers for years and was so happy when I heard you're doing a Lost rewatch. The first TV podcast I ever listened to was Lost's official podcast with Damon Lindelof, Carlton Cuse. Having the same experience of going through every single episode of the series with a podcast companion takes me back to 2005 and my brand new iPod. So maybe that is the most early 2000s thing about this episode is Paula's iPod. which I also remember having an iPod, and
yeah, it had a click wheel and they had buttons. It had buttons on it.
And that's why they're called podcasts, because you put them on your iPod.
It's crazy that they're called podcasts because of the iPod. I think I actually did not put that together until I think it was Paul F. Tompkins or something like that had a tweet recently where he was like, it's a shame they couldn't come up with a better word than podcast for like this thing that we all do. And then someone was like, they're called podcasts because of the iPod. And I know that everyone listening to this already knew that, but I was like, whoa, I didn't know.
Indeed. All right. One more thing. We did get several emails this week about whether or not saying something like next week is a Charlie episode is a spoiler. We would like to, since, you know, we may have some folks who are coming to us new, want to set some rules, set some boundaries. We do not think this is a spoiler. That's just it. It's just not a spoiler.
We're doing, I think, a pretty good job keeping, you know, spoiler free, et cetera. But I don't think we need to be precious about who has a point of view episode. So next week is, someone also was upset actually about, believe it or not, about a Game of Thrones spoiler. So I actually might try to be a little bit more mindful about that. Someone is waiting until all the books come out to read the show. So good luck with that.
Where all my humor is based out of. Damn it. Okay. Gotta wheel back more spoiler based humor.
We can just sort of like pop a spoiler for Game of Thrones reference before we say it or something like that.
Or we could just add it to the bleeps as we get further along in Lost. There will always be Game of Thrones bleeps.
But my contention is saying that next week's episode, which is titled, The Moth or Moth?
The Moth.
The Moth podcast is a Charlie episode, is not a spoiler. Because as we learn from this episode, just because it's a sun episode doesn't mean it's like all sun all the time in the episode, you know? So.
Well, I was going to say the reason we've been bringing it up, and I think, I don't know, this was entirely in the calm and that might be our problem, is it's usually about like foreshadowing. And as I've like jumped back in, I've been surprised in this rewatch of the first season how much these early episodes sort of like leave you with a question that you think you have, but throughout the episode has been peppering who the next person is. I agree. I think that is really strong, and the part of knowing that is not knowing a surprise of who the next episode's going to be about. In Game of Thrones, we would have had to just guess that if there was any episode foreshadowing. We don't have to guess here, but I think it helps to call it out because it's part of the filmmaking process.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. There are scenes where when I see them in this episode, I'm like, oh, next time on Lost.
Next time on Lost.
We'll talk about Charlie.
Charlie. All right. Charlie. Oh, poor Claire doesn't appear in this episode. That seems like a great way to get into House of the Rising Sun with the Calm. Once again, no spoilers here in the Calm. You've seen the episode, so you know that Claire hasn't appeared in it. This is apparently the first episode where not all the regulars appear, says Lostpedia, which is a great little bit for using trivia. Guys, this episode is majority subtitled as we go to South Korea to learn more about Sun and Jin while on the island. I'm doing Neil's job. Neil, what happened this episode?
Well, Dave, couple of things happened on the episode. Let's start with what happens on the island. It begins with, for something like 30 seconds, Kate is interested in Jack's tattoos, and that's that. Jin then attacks Michael on the beach for no immediately apparent reason, and then gets handcuffed. We later find out that it's all over a watch, but we'll get to that. Charlie, Locke, Jack, Kate get stung by a bunch of bees, which is never fun. Highly not recommended. So that's, you know, that happens. And then despite the fact that there are bodies in the caves, Jack decides that it's prime survival real estate. And Kate, as you might expect, is not into it because of her big Gemini energy. And then
I get that joke now.
Can I quickly say that we got so many, at least three emails of people talking about why Kate is an ideal Gemini, including our friend Grace O'Keefe, who does these great Game of Thrones food Instagram posts. She did Kate's full Gemini chart, which maybe I'll put in like the Patreon or something like that. But it is an incredible work of art. But basically, like Kate's
Are there spoilers in the Gemini chart?
Not in Grace's, and in some other emails there are some spoilers about why Kate is. There's one email that I'm looking at right now that's called Kate, comma, the obvious Gemini. but I will do a spoiler. Actually, no, I'll do a spoilerful quick read of this. This is from Vera from Sweden, and Dave can bleep what is a spoiler. So, it's obvious because she has a hard time making decisions. The most clear example being that she. I was always a shipper, but I see the beauty of as well. Kate is always very hesitant to love, which is also a trait of Geminis. She shows this towards however, it's not only about it's also about the struggles of choosing between the good and bad decisions, which reflects her personality. Indecisive, impulsive, unreliable are the three most common and negative characteristics of Geminis. Kate avoids responsibility very often, often justifying these actions with I'm not needed here. So restless, passionate, indecisive. That's our Kate.
Yep, that's Kate. All right, and then finally, the last thing that sort of happens on the island is that Locke becomes the first person to recognize Charlie from Drive Shaft, which was a goal that Charlie has really been working toward for a while here. And then he begins man of faithing him to help him kick drugs. So there's that.
Love it.
In flashback, we get, as we've noted already, the first look at what was going on with Jin and Sun. And it turns out that Jin and Sun used to be beautiful lovebirds, separated by socioeconomic classism. And now Jin just has a temper. And as the episode goes on, we learn that the reason why Jin has a temper is that Sun's father is a very demanding crime boss type. And that's cool. But we learn that even though she learned English to escape her husband, who now just comes home with bloody hands, Sun decides to stay with him. Also, Sun speaks English, which is a huge reveal, and it's great. The whole thing ends with a delightful Hurley Discman, although we found that it's not actually a Discman. It's a Panasonic. Sorry. It's another montage, and it's set to Willie Nelson's Are You Sure? And it shows us, it's a great little piece that kind of shows us who went to the caves and then who stayed on the beach. And so that's what happened this week on Lost.
Mm. Who wrote the question that came immediately after the summary in the notes?
Oh, I did.
Out yourself.
It was me, Joanna.
Joanna, do we think the show ever leans too hard at misleading us?
That's my question for you guys. I mean, okay, so here's the deal. The Sun and Jin stuff has been the hardest sell, I think, for new watched in the show. This is a topic we're going to, again, try to trickily parse in the calm. We get a little bit more info about Sun in this episode that helps us sort of deepen that. We won't, once again, I don't think this is a spoiler, we won't learn more about Jin or much more about Jin until his episode, which is much later in the season. And so for the people that I've been telling, like, just hang in there, the Kwans get better, this is one part of it, but it's not the full picture. So I promise there's, like, even more to come. But for as much as I enjoy the fact that Lost does this sort of peel back the onion look at what you think you might know about people, like our perception in this episode, our perception up till this episode that maybe Michael is a bad father. And then we get that exchange where Walt's like, well, what's my birthday? And Michael's like, I know it. What's my, you don't know it? Yep. Didn't think so. So like, you know, that sort of stuff is stuff that the show is trying to sort of intentionally mislead us. But I think with the Kwans in particular, it might go too far in trying to mislead us in a way that might put off viewers, especially viewers starting the show in 2019. So.
I don't disagree with that, but like, I think the Michael thing is a good example. Like, that's such a interesting side story to have to this particular thing, and really helps shift or keep the focus at least partially on Michael, because part of it, or part of what this episode wants us to think about initially, is the connection between Michael and Sun so far. Like, they seem to kind of get along, but he, like, ran across her dressing once, and, like, maybe they could communicate, but maybe they can't. And then now all of a sudden the husband attacks him. And at least I had forgotten how much it reads like maybe Jin figured something out about his wife, only because knowing these characters like I do, and even just knowing the end of this episode, it's, like, very fun to see how those things are peppered out from like a screenwriting perspective, where Sun tries to say, still in Korean, you know, it's about the watch, and Saeed thinks she's talking about how she needs to take the handcuffs off. And just the ability of everybody to pigeonhole themselves. And then I think in like one or two episodes, we're going to see the negative side, I think, of the groupthink even more so. And it's not necessarily with the Asian characters. So on one hand, it's 2019 touchy, but I feel like the way that they started in this base place in 2004 with, you know, an Iraqi interrogator, it's not played by an Iraqi, but still is there, this Korean couple, and then, you know, even how Hurley, you know, tries to, like, keep a good attitude with everybody, but still misidentifies the Kwans as Chinese. Like, I think that's a slightly more realistic way to approach it as 2004 characters. And then I think, you know, Michael tries to talk over that issue a little bit this episode, where he tries to explain to Saeed that, you know, Korean people don't like black people in America. And then later, when he's having that conversation with Walt, has to be like, no, we don't believe that. I don't believe that. But, you know, it comes out anyway. So it's trying to have your cake and eat it too, but I think it's as much acknowledgement as the show can do that they're treading in these controversial areas, and that they intend, or that they know they're doing it at least, and are trying to tread carefully.
Yeah, we should say that our guest on this week's episode is Huai Chambui, who is a writer for Slash Film, and she graciously, like, agreed to appear. Well, she loves Lost. She's thrilled to talk about Lost. We have this great long discussion about her middle school infatuation with the TV show Lost and all sorts of stuff like that. But, you know, I wanted to have someone on who's not the three of us to talk about like the koans and sort of Asian stereotypes and all that sort of stuff. So that is something that we get into in our you know, special side conversation that we have as part of this episode this week. You know, ooh, but I
where would people go if they wanted to get all of those side conversations?
You can go to patreon.com/normalspoilers.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to get one plug in here.
I've decided to call them fireside chats. I don't know why. I think I was going to call them like camp fireside chats, but that, or like beach fireside chats, but that became too cumbersome. I'm not as good as Neil at naming segments, but, basically like we'll have an edited version of the chat in this episode. And then if you want the full chat and want to join our Patreon at the $10 level, you can listen to like the full chat there. We've got a lot of stuff going on, for Patreon bonus content, but, I think these unedited chats are going to be, specifically a very, very fun part of that. But basically, like, I know our limitations as like two white folks and a brown dude, like trying to talk about, the Kwans and their representation on this episode. I'm not saying like, you know, everyone is allowed to have their take on whether or not it's silly that a Korean woman in 2004 who was raised with a lot of money, like a lot of our listeners have already pointed out, duh, of course she would already know how to speak English. Because like, it's silly that she wouldn't. So it's kind of silly that it's a secret. And I'm like, yep, I accept that. I accept that it's silly that that's the case. And it's just sort of like one of their like, whoa, reveals, like she speaks English. So, you know, it's as silly as a man who can't walk being healed by an island. You know, so I agree that there's inconsistencies, and I agree that there's stuff about Saeed and the Kwans, possibly about Hurley.
Oh, and I think Charlie, too. If we're just talking about broad stereotypes serving as the basis for somebody's narrative, there's a lot of that in the first season, and to the show's credit, as you stick with these characters, those things get deepened without necessarily being retconned.
Yeah, we got called out for using the word, I think, crippled to describe Locke, because that's not really a word we use anymore. It's a word they use on Game of Thrones, but it's not really a word that's used anymore. But if you go through the series, like Locke himself uses that word. But once again, it was like 2004. Ish. You know what I mean? And so like for the time, it's amazing to think about how long ago that actually was and how far we've come perception wise and how actually progressive it was for the like multiracial, at least in one case, multi-body type, multi-gender perspective, that the show brings. But like, it doesn't, of course, look perfect in a 2019 point of view. So,
and that's an extremely 2004 thing, which is like, you know, the version of like a show with a very diverse cast was, we're going to have this very diverse cast, but then we are also going to spend in the entire season sort of playing with sort of cultural stereotypes. You know, I mean, they do it with a lot of people. So I think it's okay to be like, this is what the show is doing, because it's totally what they're doing. And it's very of the time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
They took their shot and luckily made some good characters until... yeah, no, can't say that.
it's safe to assume that our initial impressions of every single character we've met so far is not the fully formed version of that character. As we're learning, like, this is one of the things about Lost is there's not everything has a simple answer. So we will learn more.
Yeah, but what is also okay is that even if you get the complicated answer and you still think it's not great, that's okay too. You know what I mean? Right. I'm not guaranteeing that every complicated version of a character is going to satisfy you from a 2019 point of view. So that's Lost. One thing I also really enjoyed in this other chat that we have coming up in this episode is this idea. Another complaint I heard from our listeners is that they were frustrated that even though this is a quote unquote sun episode, the on island plot doesn't have as much to do with her as some of our listeners would have liked. You know what I mean? For like a Locke episode, it's very Locke centric. You know, it's like, so like this is about Michael and Jin's fight and this sort of like cave subplot, but like how central is Sun to all of that? But one theory that our guest floated that I really like is this idea that do I stay or do I go? Do I dig in to the caves or stay on the beach? Is a sun, is thematically sun, even if it is not literally sun. And that might not satisfy some people, but that is something that hadn't occurred to me that I thought was interesting.
Sure. Yeah. And the other thing is that the flashbacks in this, you know, and this happens with Sun and Jin, and this happens with Michael and Walt, where it's like, it's her, all of the flashbacks about her revolve around her relationship with Jin. And so I think that's part of it, at least. I don't know if that's a good explanation, but that's part of it. Like, I feel like the show at this point knows the sort of expectation they've set with the audience for these characters. They know that the stereotypes they're playing into, and then they're starting to unravel the relationship a bit. You know, I think one of the things I'm remembering from the Lost Rewatch is how sort of methodical it is when they start peeling back the layers of different characters. So like, so far we're only really unraveling what happened between Jin and Sun. So I think it kind of works.
Well, there's also this thing as we're, you know, if this is your first time watching it, then you're about to notice that every episode has like an island thing that has to go along with the backstory. And we're still in the period of time where all those island things are very practical. They're like, we need water, we need, you know, shelter, we need boars. And we've been getting like these other hints of other things and these character backstories. But at some point, I think towards the middle of the season, they have more latitude in connecting the two stories because they become less about like concrete survival. Not everyone's going to have a Locke-like story where they prepare for this moment and then have like a huge mythical reveal. But we have to kind of learn who the people are on the beach right as it like becomes important to know that. And so I think the way that they link this episode together is by having them both go to the caves together, and you know, everything's kind of resolved, which is weak, but Joanna is right in the sense that it is the microcosm of Sun's character of making the choice of whether or not she's going to stay with Jin.
I think
Yeah,
well, I think having just completed my full rewatch of the series, yay, I did it. I went all over the series. I have, you know, I remember liking the Sun and Jin stuff a little bit more than I wound up liking it on the rewatch. So like, I still have some issues, which we will get to in like 3 or 4 years or so. But like with the ending, but also something that I noticed, even from first time watchers of like that is like, you like, okay, Kate, all right, Charlie, okay, Sawyer, and then people say Sun and Jin, like they're a unit, you know? And that's, I mean, you know, that it would be nice if that weren't the case for, you know, these two characters, to be continually, a unit. I would like to have a little bit more individuation for them, but that's, you know, that's okay. That there are married couple, I guess there's another married couple, which we will talk about at some point that also get the same treatment, but that's okay.
Also, let's remember to come back to this in a storm because the show doubles down on that idea in a later way.
Cool. All right. How fun is this for people to listen to?
I want to talk about ships. Yeah. Here we go. All right. So one of the things that's sort of overlooked because we've rewatched the series is we kind of know how all the couplings worked out. I rewatched this and everybody's so freaking about romance in this episode. So it starts off with like Jack and Kate being all buddy buddy to the point that like Charlie notices it and then makes like a snide comment and continues to make snide comments at Kate like he's attracted to Kate and Kate's already rejected him, which seemed weird and aggressive. They play like Michael and Sun could have like some sort of romance thing. I don't think it's entirely cut out by the end of this episode just because they don't reference it. We have Kate kind of flirting with Saeed a little bit and Sawyer calling her out for it after her mind's kind of moved on because she's sort of like breaking up with Jack in her mind. Why did we hit the gas so hard for House of the Rising Sun?
Yeah, Neil.
Oh, this is just the show's weird Kate stuff. Well, at the beginning, you know, it is really interesting. And I don't know. I mean, how would you react if you were on an island and it started to become apparent that you're not going to be rescued? Because I think this is a good point for, you know, obviously there's the metaphorical significance. There's also the literal significance at the end of who goes to the cave and sort of accepts that we're going to be here for a while, who stays on the beach. But also, I mean, this is the point where people, you got to start thinking about not just survival, but what happens when you get horny.
Oh,
which is an important element of this.
Okay, so Neil says day seven, trapped on a desert island.
7 days feels about that's right to me.
The 7 day itch, sure.
Yeah, that's the first day that you're allowed to be like, seriously, guys, like, I see you checking me out.
Yeah,
just tell me if you're into this.
Right. So in the show, I think from like a production standpoint, the show is almost trying stuff out at this point. It's hard to say that that's true because they probably wrote a bunch of episodes in advance, but maybe even just in as they were writing it, they sort of tried out different things, and they obviously don't land on any answers in this episode.
There's
I'll go first then. According to Lostpedia, there was an extended scene that got cut of Jack helping Kate up after she fell after taking off her shirt, so he could, you know, notice that she had taken off her shirt. Which, you know, glad that got cut.
Two things. Number one, there's a spoilery Garfunkel and Oates song called Why Isn't There More Fucking on This Island that you can't listen to until you finish the show. But if you finish the show, you can listen to Garfunkel and Oates talking about Why Isn't There More Fucking on This Island, which is like, yeah, this is an island. People's clothes offer a lot and there are very attractive people there. So, of course, why isn't there more fucking on this island? Do you think that this is why there's the Adam and Eve, like in the cave? It's all like sexy times. I mean, they're dead people, but also like the implication. Well, I guess it speaks to sort of like obvious Gemini Kate. You know what I mean? And Jack's like, let's go into this cave and be here and set up camp.
Let's start
and
a life together in this cave.
And she's
cave.
Like, guess what? I don't want to be those skeletons in that cave. So I'm going to stay on this.
It's kind of like she flips on it because she thinks that he's thinking the same thing he is. She's like, oh, coupling. Because as they're walking away from the cave, that's when they have the whole, like, are you checking me out conversation.
Yeah, she's like, just say it. Just say what you're thinking. Don't even think about it. Just say it. Just say it.
And
don't.
Jack's like, okay, yeah, I was thinking, you know, there's some natural covering for the cave. And she's just like, oh no. And then later she comes back at him with like, I don't want to be Eve, which is,
yeah.
I don't, like, she's under a lot of emotional stress.
It's a lot.
Been 7 days on an island. She's a fugitive.
It's a lot. This brings me to, this week's edition of What's the Most 2004 Thing About This Episode, which is a truncated, segment this week. I only have two candidates. Number one is, Hurley's Not Discman. Whatever it's actually is.
It's a Panasonic something, something,
CD player.
Something.
It's Panasonic something, man. So that, or, is it, the fact that Kate takes her shirt off and Lost felt like it was okay to have a likable character make a dumb boob joke about her. So which is the most 2004 thing about this episode? Dave?
Bees in the shirt.
Bees in the shirt. Neil?
I'm going with the CD player.
All right.
So that's when I had a CD player.
Okay. CD player. It's a dead heat. So do you listeners think it's bees in the shirt or CD player? Which one do you think it is? Anyway. And then lastly, someone requested a new segment, which unfortunately this week is a very racially charged, which is please, tell us all the new Sawyer nicknames of the episode. This week it's just Omar and Captain Falafel, both directed at, of course, Saeed. So, and then I think Hurley once again misidentifies Jin and says that Chinese dude is going to get pretty crispy or something like that.
Yep.
So, you know, Hurley still has not learned that the Kwans are Korean and Sawyer is calling Saeed Omar and Captain Falafel. So
yeah, the nickname segment's going to get a lot more fun later on.
Later.
We swear there's a reason people want that segment.
And, I don't know. Maybe some people are offended by freckles. I'm just saying.
Oh yeah, we don't know for sure. But Sawyer nicknames are a thing. You know, the writers get better with them as the season moves on. All right, let's talk about the central conflict here. The Lostpedia page has all these bloopers from the airport scene, which made me realize I did not even notice, because in terms of like flashback scenes, I think that's the first one that is like a sustained emotional beat. Like, Kate's is about action, Locke's is about like revelation, Jax is about ghost dad, like dad problems. This one, it's like a whole romance shoved together, but instead of going for like the full Romeo and Juliet moment, we get the full escalator of doubt at 11:15 in the Australian airport, where apparently there's a woman who looks at the camera 5 times, which Lostopedia has noted, because Lostopedia has all the facts. Neil, what did you think about the flashback narrative in this scene? Was it effective in keeping the focus on Sun while also including Jin?
Yeah, I think so. Because like I said, we're in stage one of unraveling what it is that sort of informs how they act initially on the island. And I think we get such a dense backstory in just this one episode, and actually in not a lot of dialogue. I mean, you mentioned that a lot of it is subtitled, but there's also just a lot of sort of moody stuff in these Sun and Jin flashbacks. And then there's not a lot of dialogue in the final scene, which, you know, ultimately is about what's going on inside of Sun's mind at 11:15, and then Jin having the flower, and sort of the sweet old original Jin comes out for a second, and it helps, I guess, change her mind. It's a super emotional scene. I actually forgot, and this is, you know, it's easy to forget things that happened 15 years ago. But I forgot how, like, caught up in the end that I got in like Sun's ultimate choice, because I still think, like, at this point, I don't know enough about Sun and Jin to be like, girl, why are you not leaving? Like, you need to go. Like, you did all this planning. You need to go. Right. And she doesn't. So, you know, I think that's one of the things that Lost does. It's like, it's answering a question and asking a question at the same time. So it's answering the question of why was Sun on the plane? Because she decided not to leave Jin at 11:15. But it's also opening up more questions about, you know, is there more to this story? Is there more to why Sun didn't leave Jin? Because I hope there is, because otherwise, if that's all we were ever to get to know about Sun and Jin, I'd be like, why did you not leave? That was the dumbest thing ever.
What we know now is that it's a major line for Neil if you come home with blood on you. That's like an uncrossable thing.
Puppy, sure. Yeah. Blood, bad.
Blood, bad. Although I do always, you know, especially at this point, wonder what Sun was doing in her life before Jin went to work for her father. Like, did she not know anything about her father or the type of business he did? So those are questions for another episode, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I know they're like, Jin says he makes like a 2-year agreement, and one's like at the factory, he says, but we don't have like any indication of that, because at that point in the episode, we're supposed to think maybe it's normal. Maybe they're just lifting up poor Jin to another strata. But it turns out it's much more devious than that. I want to go back to the airport. Wait. Because last... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to talk about the airport. Really quickly, we'll talk about why that scene was maybe so emotional. We talked about that a little bit in the chat that you'll hear later in this episode. But also something that I didn't notice until maybe like my third or fourth time watching this episode. I watched these episodes so many times. Is I was watching it last night and I was doing something else. And this is a hard episode to multitask and watch, but it was sort of like my last rewatch. And it's a hard one because so much of it is subtitled, right? So like, you don't want to look away. So I was like doing it. I was looking away when I could and then looking back for all the Korean. And what's fascinating about Sun's choice, it is a very lengthy shot of just her face. Well, not just her face, but her silently deciding.
With real tears.
Yeah. I mean, I just like, I kept looking back up. I was like, oh, are we still on this? Like, we're still on her, figuring it out. So anyway, you shout out to Yunjin Kim, who does an incredible job. I think she's actually one of the strongest performers on the show. especially given how much she's forced to do in these early episodes without being able to actually use her fucking words. But this silent moment, I then like stopped and rewound it and watched the whole thing. And she's just doing so much with her face. I just wanted to shout it out. So
she's actually, it's so good that until my final time rewatching this, which was just before we jumped on to record, I had totally forgotten slash did not notice that like Jack is standing there. Like Jack, like we get a bunch of Jack's conversation with the gate agent.
That's why I said last week that you see the that Jack gate agent conversation so many times in the show. This is right. This is only the second time, but we'll be back.
Yeah, that's the pivot point I wanted to use. That was an example of how last week's episode was foreshadowing this week's episode. As I alluded to at the beginning of the podcast, that happens a lot. Next week's episode is going to be a Charlie episode, like Neil said. So let's turn our attention to Locke and Charlie, who, as Neil rightly said, Locke's man of faithing Charlie, who, okay, so.
Or buddy Joanna. Of faith, which is what Kim Renfro and I decided to call them after the Watership Down conversation. Anyway, yeah.
Or the buddy of faith. Yeah. When did Locke find the guitar?
Oh, I think during this episode, like, I think he notices it while he's talking to Charlie. I don't think he, like, sets the whole thing up for that. I think he, you think he already knew it was there?
I think it seems dumb for Locke to make such a strong promise to somebody he doesn't know that early on. So I think by the time he says, you know, you'll see your guitar again.
Yeah, you'll see her. Okay.
I think he's already, well, not even like before the drug exchange, the first time he says it, like, I think he already knows.
Ooh,
like,
that's a long con, which once again is a phrase I learned from the TV show Lost. that's a long con that John Locke is setting up there.
Well, we don't necessarily know because Locke at this point is, he's a major power player on the island. So I don't even know what he does or doesn't know. And he's one of those characters because we know he's keeping the miracle secret from everybody except maybe Walt. It's hard to know what secrets he's keeping from us, even through dialogue. So it's hard to believe anything he says for
he's
me.
Inscrutable, ineffable.
He is inscrutable and ineffable, as opposed to like Jack, who's an open wound, who's like, I'm chasing my father through the jungle right now. Leave me alone. People are like, there's a water crisis. He's like, I don't care. I just, my ghost dad's over there, maybe.
Oh, speaking of ghost dad, really quickly, a friend of the pod, Katie Rich, shouted out. I think I called Christian Shepherd my favorite ghost dad in all of television. And she pointed out that Richard Jenkins on 6 Feet Under is probably the best ghost dad in all of television. And I concede the point to Katie Rich. So Richard Jenkins, 6 Feet Under, probably takes the cake. Ghost dad extraordinaire.
I have a question.
Yes.
Do we think that Locke really knew about Drive Shaft before the island, or is it something that he heard in passing?
Ooh.
Do you think when Locke landed on the island, not only did the island cure his spine, it gave him a short dossier backstory on all the other survivors, so he could be like, blue rugby shirt lady. I know you from your oatmeal commercials or like something like that.
I think on one hand, I think he actually knows it because he knows the title of both albums. On the other hand, I think your self-titled debut was better is like the most basic bitch criticism to give
pandering.
Any band.
so pandering.
I don't know for sure, Neil.
We spent several moments in the early episodes with Charlie telling people about the fact that he played bass in Drive Shaft
and so guitar sometimes.
If John Locke has just been creeping, he would know this, and he uses it as an in to get to know Charlie better.
He doesn't even need to be creeping. Charlie tried to talk to him about it while he was carving the whistle, and John Locke chose not to say anything.
So
it is weird that he's been holding back.
I noticed your really ugly ring. Could you perhaps be in the band Drive Shaft? I hate that ring so much. We're going to talk about it more. What was I going to say? Oh, according to Lostpedia, originally Locke was supposed to call Charlie Mr. Pace a bunch, like, before he finally called him Charlie or something like that. In order to, that was supposed to reveal the fact that he does know who he is, that he's Charlie Pace of Drive Shaft. But I really like your creepy Locke gathering intel.
Right. And like, well, and see, I disagree a little bit with Dave. I think that Locke probably like saw the guitar as he was walking up to Charlie and he sort of on the spotted it, because Locke is very cagey, and very good in the moment.
Sure. Yeah. A brief con.
Ooh, that was a quick con.
A real quick con from John Locke.
Ooh, I've got a quick con I could pull off right now. It's going to be the little internal, once you get to the internal monologues of Lost that are played out in soliloquies, you're going to really enjoy all the silly Locke jokes. I'm joking. That doesn't happen in the show. I'm sorry. I wouldn't say that in the column and not bleep it out if it were true. All right. Unless we have Willie Nelson thoughts nobody else has had before, I'm tempted to throw the interview. Joanna, is there anything else we need to cover in the column?
No, I think we're good to go. Let's get to it. All right, our guest today is another Lost fanatic. Huai Chen Bui is a staff writer and film critic at Slash Film. You tweeted recently something along the lines of, have you ever thought about how Lost is a perfect TV show? And that signaled to me that I should talk to you. Hello, how are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for having me on. And I'm very excited to talk Lost. It is one of my favorite TV shows ever. And I am one of the ardent defenders of the final season, despite it being wildly unpopular, even amongst its fans.
Yes. But first, I want to talk to you in a spoiler-free way about your Lost origin story. How did you first come to watch the show?
Yeah, it's a show that I grew up with through high school, and I found friends who had the same love for Lost as I did. And gonna be super nerdy, but in the last on the finale, mm-hmm. when the show was ending, my friends and I actually who watched Lost with decided to, you know, put tape on our fingers and write in the Charlie way.
Nice.
As we were super nerdy and we wanted to mourn Lost in our way while going to class that day. So,
love it. Love yeah. that.
And, I remember, after every episode of Lost, I would love to read the Entertainment Weekly recaps by Jeff Jensen. And these were 8-page recaps.
Yeah.
And, I just love the way that the show was ready made to be dissected, and that there were so many things that you could catch on the first, second, and third watch. And I haven't really seen a show since then that really encouraged that kind of theorizing and that kind of excitement around just the end of an episode.
Yeah, no, Jeff owned that beat back in mm-hmm. the day on Entertainment Weekly. And I think to your point earlier about the controversial final season, I think it's possible that the way in which some people felt burned on the ending of Lost is mm-hmm. why perhaps some other shows have shied away from exactly emulating it. Though also other shows have certainly tried to emulate it and failed many times over. All right. Do you have a favorite Lost character?
Yes. His name is Desmond. I'm sure many of you know. I think actually the reason right before you asked me to be on this episode, you were tweeting about Desmond and his one shirt that he has to the yes. entire show. And it is my favorite shirt. I love that he just is perpetually missing the top two buttons of his shirt. I love The Constant is one of my favorite episodes of Lost, and Desmond is just a perfect character in that episode, and I really love his central revolving around love and also the weirder elements that he introduces once he comes onto the show.
Which we will talk about in the future. But yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I've been, you know, reaching out to people, asking them their favorite character to see if they'll come on for that character's episode. And a lot of people are mentioning future characters. And I'm like, okay, but how about season one? And it's funny because I think people really love season one. The structure works so well for season one. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of fan favorite characters don't come on until season twos and three. And so that that'll be fun to talk about when we get there. So as for this episode, House of the Rising Sun, what do you think works best about the episode as a contained story?
One of the great conceits of the show is that it allows us to be very embedded in the perspective of a different character in every episode, and yet this one feels very much more deliberate in terms of just like this is Sun and Jin's story, most specifically Sun's. I like the introduction of Sun and Jin and like their love story and how it kind of it parallels the conflict going on in the island, which is the beach versus the caves conflict. Mm-hmm. And at first read, it wasn't something that felt very connected. But I don't know if this is exactly a spoiler.
Try me and we'll see.
I think that the central conflict on the island does reflect Sun's inner turmoil in her marriage with Jin, which I think was quite subtle in the storytelling, but it does work. So yeah, my favorite parts of this episode is probably just how much we are in Sun's perspective, and how it doesn't, even though we have other subplots and like B plots with the other characters, it doesn't, you know, treat her like that side supporting character that we've seen in the past couple episodes.
So I think what you're saying is that this idea of the cave versus the beach, but do you mean sort of like a stay or go sort of thing? Okay. Yeah.
The whole stay or go.
Yeah.
Dynamic, the conflict, the idea of kind of making your bed.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. That's mm-hmm. so interesting. Yeah, because one of the critiques that I've heard from people, you know, and I've heard from a lot of first-time watchers, they're having a really hard time with the Sun and Jin dynamic because the show so intentionally makes you think it's one thing before revealing that it's another, which is just something the show does over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And so it's been hard for me to try to tell people in a non-spoiler way, just like, hang on, I promise it gets better sort of thing. But one complaint I heard about this episode was they didn't like how much the island plot seemed disconnected from the Sun plot when, you know, in Kate's episode and Locke's episode, the on-island plot and the flashback plot were so obviously connected. And so I really like that you pull out that this is sort of a more subtle thematic connection between the two.
It's more embedded in the ending of the episode and where you see like the different characters sitting and or standing rather in the beach versus the caves conflict. I think that it's a quote from the writer whose name that I feel like I'm going to mispronounce. What is his last name is Griot.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Yeah. It's Javier Griot Marxwatch.
So he said that this episode is about the survivors becoming full-time island dwellers, and that's what kind of clicked in my connection of this being about Sun deciding to stay with Jin in the final scene. That idea of, like I said, making do with the bed that you've made.
Right, the dig-in sort of thing. Do you have anything about the episode that doesn't work so well for you upon rewatch?
I think that the bees subplot was a little bit just very – I remember the writer also said that he – this was just like a personal fear of his. And I think that the bees don't really play an essential part in this episode at all except to give us another reason for Kate to take her shirt off.
Yep.
That was really noticeable to me again this time around. I do really like, how it made, Charlie more central and like that it kind of introduced that Charlie Locke, rehabilitation, dynamic. But the bees they were really dumb.
Yeah. Yeah. Once Evangeline Lilly is in her bra again, you're like, okay, I see what you did there. Fair enough. And it's interesting to me, like, you know, to get to your perspective, obviously, specifically on the treatment of the Kwans and like what you think of, it's hard to talk about in a non-spoiler way up to this point, because like this is a Sun episode, but we don't get a Jin episode until like much later in the season. And I think that's another piece of the, you know, you get one part of the puzzle here, you get another part later. I don't think it's spoilers to say you get another part later. There's more to learn, but I think people watching the first time and expecting this episode to sort of explain everything might find, okay, I still have some issues with maybe some of the stereotypes I feel like I'm seeing specifically as they apply to Jin. So what thoughts you had in that regard?
Yeah, I had issues too with some of the stereotypes, leading up to this episode and also in this episode, the idea of the really strict, borderline abusive husband and the wife who is, you know, trying to adhere to these traditional, you know, expectations. And, but I will say, that when I first watched Lost, I think Sun and Jin were my first exposure to a Korean couple on like a mainstream American TV show. I think until now it was really rare to see that in a mainstream show for me and for many of the audience. So they were working with stereotypes. And I know that this episode was sort of an intention to sort of peel back those stereotypes and give a fuller depiction of both of them. I don't think it fully succeeds in that because, like you said, it's still really embedded in Sun's perspective. And we don't get to see much of Jin apart from, you know, he is the lower class sort of server who falls in love with the high class woman and ends up working for her father and going into this darker and violent path. I do think that, you know, it abides by those stereotypes because it's something that we haven't yet seen that much of on, mainstream American TV. I won't say that it's completely inauthentic, though, despite it being very stereotypical. The idea of social and class conflict is very common in just like Korean society. I will say I am Vietnamese American. I can't speak for Korean culture, Korean society. Right. This is just my own observations based off of, you know, Korean dramas and Korean films that I've seen. And I feel like that aspect at least is sort of authentic, and the way that some of the aspects, like, they have some root in truth, but it isn't quite as like cartoonish as we've seen up until now, which I think is good. It's starting to try to depict something a little bit more authentic.
Yeah, it's interesting. We were talking about this also in the context of Saeed, where it's like, you have Saeed, this Iraqi character, and then you know, it comes to light that he was, you know, a torturer in the Republican Guard, and you're like, oh great, the Iraqi torturer. But then like what Lost does, once again, we haven't got a Saeed episode, so not to spoil anything, but like what Lost tries to do is play with those stereotypes a little bit. But I think, you know, for 2004, that in and of itself was an interesting thing to do, present you with a stereotype and then say, okay, but it's what you think you're looking at is not what you're looking at, right?
Right. And right on the heels of 9/11 too, which is really interesting.
But I think even like, I think probably from a 2019 perspective, we're like, okay, but you don't even need to start with a stereotype. We're good. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
it's a little creaky still.
Yeah, absolutely. It's creaky, but, you know, for its day, progressive. And now we're like, okay, blow the dust off of this. It's not exactly, you know, what we're looking for. So, yeah.
I will say one thing that I noticed upon this rewatch is that Daniel Dae Kim's accent is really not natural at all. When he's speaking in Korean. And that's something I didn't really notice back when I was first watching, but now upon having seen like more Korean films and everything, it is easy to tell that he speaks like a Korean American. So I just think that that is a little interesting. And I wonder if it, kind of works toward how, stiff he is at the beginning. That might be like part of his characterization, but I feel like he does act a little bit stiff and a little awkward at the beginning, maybe because it's not his first language.
I didn't even think about that. It's funny because, you know, he sort of struggles through it. And I didn't know that until this rewatch when I, heard from some Korean speakers. They're like, oh, his accent is awful. I was like, oh, good to know. Noted. Even worse actually is Naveen Andrews as Saeed, because when we get to the Saeed episode, we'll see that, his attempt at, Arabic is so bad that they had to sort of like do a trick with it. You know what I mean?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. So his is very bad. So at least Daniel Day Kim's was good enough that he could like struggle through the series. And I think, I mean, to my untrained ear, having just rewatched the whole series, I think it gets better, but, understandably. Yeah. And I hadn't thought about that informing his, like, the stiffness of his performance. Like that, that makes a lot of sense to me. All right. And in terms of like what else is going on in this episode, you mentioned you like the Locke and Charlie dynamic. We roll our eyes at, Kate taking her shirt off again. What about sort of some of the Michael stuff? For me, I will just say quickly, in the rewatch, I don't remember Harold Perrineau's. I remember making a lot of fun of Harold Perrineau's, performance as Michael, for reasons we'll talk about later. He sort of like becomes a famous meme, but like, in these early episodes, I like his performance so much more than I remember liking it. What do you think of like Michael and Walt in this episode?
I like his performance too. I still am not completely warm to his character because I think he is still written in a very, I don't want to say flat way, but kind of aggressive way. Also, I feel like aggressive is a misnomer too, because that makes it sound like his character is overly aggressive. I just think that the way that his character is written is very in your face. It's like, this is him. He's just like, he's very, he wears his emotions on his sleeves and everything. I do like his performance, the dynamic between him and Jin is interesting. I didn't realize this back in the time because I was really young, but I do know that, executives for when this episode was first written balked at the idea of a Korean man, beating a black man because of just like the racial implications. And I think that the episode, does, bring light to it, bring attention to it, but it doesn't make it overly an issue more than it should be, because we do find out like the reasons why they come to blows. But this is just an issue of just like my liking his character. I'm not completely warm to him, but I do like that he is Harold Perrineau, I think, shows how he's struggling and kind of caught between his son and being very confused as just like as the survivor, and also suddenly find himself at the end of the anger of Jin. So he does well with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then this is silly question that I might ask you. It's just sort of like there's a fight between, because why not? Listen, we got two shots of Evangeline Lilly with her shirt off. So here's my question. We have a fight between Jin and Michael in the water, and then like Saeed and Sawyer come and, break it up. And so it's like basically like four hunks wrestling, in the water, like on a scale of like 1 to 10, like how hunky is this as this like moment of four men wrestling in the waves here?
It's pretty hunky. It's a lot of testosterone just flying around everywhere. And I think Michael's shirt gets torn even more.
Yeah.
I enjoy it. And I do really like this moment because it establishes Saeed and Sawyer as the sort of the strong men of the group without really doing much exposition into it. Like immediately they jump into this fight and they're the strong men, like the watchmen of the survivors. And I like that, how easily it establishes that. And yes, I do like the wrestling in the water.
Yeah, Saeed has a classic Saeed tank on. No, it's funny that you mentioned that because, yeah, it's another instance, and we talked about this in White Rabbit, of a bunch of other survivors just kind of standing on the beach and watching this happen until, like, and I was watching it with my roommate who's watching it for the first time, and she's like, why are all those red shirts standing there? And then, like, of course, you got to wait for the named characters, Saeed and Sawyer, come running into frame to sort of bust things up. So, but I like your point that it sort of makes them the people keep calling each other sheriff. Like, who's the sheriff of this little like society that they're building here?
One thing I want to say is that, you know, personally, I've never been a huge fan of the Sun and Jin episodes. I do like how the relationship evolves later on, but at the beginning, and I always found that their storylines were always a little soapy. But I think that is actually one of the advantages of Lost, in that each character-centric episode allows the show to explore sort of a different genre. In the Sun and Jin episodes, they are a Korean soap opera. In the Kate episodes, they become a crime drama. In the Locke episodes, they become this character tragedy. And I think that that is where the show is starting to explore what it can do and the depths of the character writing that it can try to do. And that's what I like about this episode, and about how what it kind of does for the structure of Lost from now on.
I love that. I hadn't thought of it exactly that way, but that fun ability to dip into genres. So if you love Korean soaps, this is the episode for you, and you will get another one before the season is out. So this is a section of the podcast where we shout out our, we used to call them small council, things that you guys should be aware of. Small council, you know that you get to pick one of our bonus pod segments, storm chasing segments. You get to pick one, choose your own storm. If you dip into the Slack, you will find a form where you can sort of submit some ideas, and we'll do a whole voting process. But that's like exercise your right to vote. If you want to pick something for us to talk about, you have that option, small council members. You also get a bonus mailbag episode this month, as well as our extended fireside chats and all sorts of good stuff. So that is...
And this Sunday, we're going to watch a Godzilla movie that I think is great, and most of you are going to think is terrible.
Great! Dave will subject you to a Godzilla movie. So what are you waiting for? Join the Patreon at the $10 level, and join the following people. Tennille Ray, Lisa Schwabenbauer, Abby Bateman, Martine Payton, Victoria Yoder, Natalia Gould, Caroline, Anne Tawarodome, Caitlin McCarthy, Casey, Brandy Franklin, Rajiv Dasani, David Felice, Lauren Goldberg, Dana O'Keefe, Rick Locke, Megan Raybone, Chris B., Izzy McAllister, and Lori Bonar. Thank you guys so much.
And I'd like to add to the list of our boundless thanks, Jackie Mox, Pekka Kaskimaki, Chase, Shannon Black, George McGee, Mike Sickles, C. Leon, Sean Ambrol, Andrea Ward, Emily Sully, Dan Allen, Susan Flanagan, Amanda Trivet, Henry McGreen, Jax Frankovich, Zachary McQuiston, yes, Melissa Scroggs, Matt Terrell, Jennifer Boucher, and Michael.
And I would like to round out our thanks by thanking the following people: Christina Brosius, Rachel Fisher Bramble, Monty Cross, Christina Tricate, Audrey T., Brian Moon, Susan Kustush, okay, Beatriz Yaganuma, Danielle Shepherd, Aeonius West, Vicky Huang, Rip Van Rubin, Melinda Rubin, Yuki Okada, Elizabeth Stelner, Lisa Schultz, Jason Hartman, Ainsley Clark, Justina Auer, and Samantha Gonzalez. Thank you all very, very much.
And it's time for The Storm, the part where we spoil all of Lost with all of our mind grapes juiced into beautiful mind wine. Joanna leads the storm now because I say things like mind wine in the first 3 minutes.
That's so funny because my friend and I used to have this thing where we would call like something about mind grapes, your sticky mind grapes. Anyway, that's not helpful. All right.
Yeah, sticky mind wine is definitely better than not sticky mind wine.
Now is the time on the storm when we check in with Dave on our weekly report of Locke, villain, antagonist, or foil. Dave?
Yes. So
all three.
While Jack is actually the person who is encompassing our faith versus science argument, I feel by making people choose between the caves and the beach. Locke is off doing his own thing, searching for weakness to exploit in Charlie. Back on the Lostopedia, as part of the production notes, they say that Locke would have drawn more out of Charlie, specifically about shooting a polar bear and something about the radio signal, by, you know, probing him for more information for selfish means. So I think Locke absolutely knew where the guitar was in the first place.
Wow.
Maybe even placed it somewhere where Charlie would have to leave it to go to the bathroom, waited to stop him so he could fucking look up, because Locke is devious.
You think Locke fucking climbed up that tree and put a guitar in the tree?
Yep.
Neil, do you think Locke climbed up a tree and put a guitar in the tree?
No, I think he saw it when he walked up. But I think
next episode he makes a snare in an even taller tree that is even not even close to rocks.
I just think that Locke, you're right that he has ulterior motives in almost every situation. But I don't know if he's like master plan scheming. I think that Locke is, he really is at this moment in this like bubble of pure belief that the island brought him here for a reason. So he's just like going with whatever and it's trying like, to use every yeah. little moment to turn some sort of advantage to him later.
I agree. I think of it more as zealotry than like manipulation. That being said, something that I think it's fun to think about, the obvious like con man to watch is Sawyer, who has adopted all of the like lessons from Anthony Cooper or whatever. But like Locke is his father's son. Anthony Cooper is his father. So like I was thinking of this when I was rewatching The Man from Tallahassee, which it sees Locke sort of duping Sawyer into killing his father because he can't kill his own father. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, the con man in this episode is Locke himself. You know what I mean? Like he's doing the con. He's like his dad's son. I think it is worth keeping an eye on like when Locke is a con man on the island. I think you can't hold an on-screen character accountable for something that was in an earlier draft of a script. Do you know what I mean? Like,
in terms of like, you're an actor, you sit down and you're portraying a character that you don't know the end of, which is the reality of it, which I'm trying to square with having seen all of Lost. It just reads very interesting to me that both Locke and the Smoke Monster are able to like sniff out Charlie's weakness like immediately. And as soon as Charlie like wants to dip in his little bag, Locke's like, I could use this. And he hasn't exerted any power over Charlie yet. That doesn't seem positive, but he has exerted power over him.
Well, I also think that at this point in the show, what are we on? Episode six? That Locke is the only person who's thinking super strategically. Everyone else is in a different form of panic still. So like Jack is still still trying to like put out fire. Every fire that comes along, whereas Locke's the only one who's like comfortable with the fact that he's on the island because of this belief that he's supposed to be there. So he's like, at this point, not thinking about getting off the island. He's thinking about like, I need to start bringing people into my way of thinking slowly. So that's, I've always thought of it very simply at this point. Granted, as we get on, we learn more about him, but I think that's all the show really wants us to take from it at this point.
I mean, doesn't it seem devious before there's any conversation? I mean, this episode is the first conversation.
He just seems unusually calm about
the
whole thing.
I think that Locke also is enjoying his position as like not the most obviously weak person in a crowd. And I'm not saying that as in like, if you're in a wheelchair, you're the most obviously weak person. It's just like, that's how Locke's been treated. And I think that's the like, very sort of defensive position he's taken the entire time he's in the chair. Like, your own perceptions about what it means to be in a chair and what it means to be out of a chair aside, Locke's attitude to it through the entire series is one of like self-loathing, like I've been defeated, I'm weak. Like every time he has to look at that chair, every scene where someone puts him in the chair, he's like, no, this is weakness for me. you know, and that's his own self-esteem thing. And I don't agree that that's what that equals, but that's what Locke felt like it equals. And so for him to be out of the chair, I think part of it is he's really enjoying his position of like, I can hunt, I can provide, I can be a leader type, I can be magnanimous and dispense wisdom, I can take care of Jack when he needs me, I can take care of Charlie when he needs me. Later, you know, we see a lot of him doing that with Claire this season, you know what I mean? Like, it's slightly manipulative in that he wants all these people to lead him because he's convinced he has the answer, but I don't think it's maliciously manipulative, would be my take on it.
Yeah, I also think he's enjoying. Well, they like think about the flashbacks that we've seen. Like, what else happened in the flashbacks that we saw from Locke, you know, a couple episodes ago? It wasn't just that he was in the wheelchair. It was that he was sort of bullied for some of the things that he really enjoyed, which is like, you know, he what do they call him? He's the colonel or the captain?
Yeah, the colonel.
But so that implies that he has these interests in like strategy and survival. And, you know, obviously he's studying to go walkabout. So this is something that people used to actively bully him for that is now the most useful thing in the group of survivors, which is that he can hunt and track and all that stuff. So I agree. Yeah. I think he's really just living his best life at the moment.
I really relate to this because like, I feel like I have been in similar situations where like when I was younger, I like just, you know, felt like I had no answers to anything. And I still have very few answers to things, but like you do get to enjoy at least having like survived a certain number of years on this planet, a certain shred of wisdom that then when you meet someone who's like a teen or something like that and is floundering around, you're like, okay, listen, this is what it was like for me in high school. Like it'll get better or whatever it is. And so like, and that feels like good, not just because you're helping someone, but also you're just sort of like, oh, I have some answers to some questions now. That's nice. That's better than my position before. But this takes me into my follow-up question, which is, something I'm enjoying about rewatching the show with my roommate Diana, our producer on the show, is she's a newcomer. So when she says things, I get to be like, oh, just wait 2 seconds or whatever it is. And so when Jack was making all these decisions about like what they do, Diana immediately was like, wait, but she's like, just a few episodes ago, like Saeed was standing on a like stump and telling people what to do. She's like, why is Jack the de facto leader and stuff like that? And then that becomes a question of this episode. Saeed's like, who elected you? And my follow-up question is like, who elected all of, like, Saeed's like, why didn't you tell us? And by us, he meant like some sort of small council, basically, because he certainly didn't mean all
of
the survivors.
Well, also, like, who elected you is real rich coming from the guy who handcuffed a Korean to a piece
right,
of wreckage.
Exactly. So my question is like, this idea, I think we've talked about this before a little bit, but this idea of like, who is the best leader? Who does feel like the best leader for the group at this point? Do they need one leader? Do they need a small body of like people who look good in tank tops to like rule them? Like, what do they need? So, I guess starting with Neil, like, what do you think of that leadership question right now in the series?
Well, I think that it's still super ambiguous as to who is right. Because I forget if it's in this, it's not in this episode. It's in like one of the next couple episodes where Sawyer and Kate have a conversation where he accuses her of being the new sheriff. And so you get, I feel like season one, there's a lot of this. There's a lot of like toying with the idea of like, who do you follow and who, upon what basis are they making their decisions, you know, for, like we were talking about with Locke, it's a lot of faith-based stuff that he's not sharing with everyone. With Jack, it's more practical. It's more science-based. And I think this episode puts the question out there and halfway answers it because we sort of see at the end that it's like Hurley is following Jack. Sun and Jin are following Jack. It's made to look like a bunch of the sort of non-named characters also follow them to the caves. But it's some of the most striking, more upfront personalities that we've met so far also stayed on the beach. So I think they're using it to create additional tension later. And I don't know if the show at this point has sort of figured it out, but this is sort of the beginning of playing Locke and Jack very sort of against each other. But that started last week, I guess, too. So
these few episodes are really feel like a product of the show being like, all right, we're Survivor with mysteries. And then being like, well, what does Survivor have? Like these fucking debates over where to build shelter, which isn't to say that it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But it seems like there's an easy solution where you just like keep people stationed at the fire, but move the majority of the people to the caves. But we can't have that actual discussion because we need to have a scene where Saeed apologizes to Michael just so he could like try to get him on his
side. See, that's the manipulative play. The most manipulative play is Saeed coming up and apologizing. And at least Michael sees through him and is like, I know that's not why you came over here. You know what right. I mean? Saeed is it's alliance time. Right. And Saeed's like,
it seems like only Saeed and Locke are paying attention to.
Well, and Jack is like kissing babies and shaking hands, and Saeed sees that and he's like, cool, I can do that too. Sorry, Michael. Want to stay here on the beach with me?
He puts his arms behind him. He holds his arms behind him and kind of like leans forward.
Well, and I think it's also, it's important that to recognize the difference in the types of manipulation. So like Jack and Saeed have this ideological difference between are we going to get saved soon or not? And they're trying to convince other people. The way Locke has been working is he seems to be cultivating relationships. So we don't know what Locke wants from Charlie yet, but we know that he's now taken an interest in Charlie and he's trying to build bridges to people. Whereas I like I said, it's this whole calm versus panic thing where it's like Locke is the only one who's calmly trying to basically network on this island and see who he can trust, see who he can use to help him do whatever it is the island wants him to do next. Whereas both Saeed and Jack's decisions are based in this still like panic about how do we survive? So for Jack, it's like, how do we keep people alive? For Saeed, it's like, how do we continue lighting this fire so that we'll get rescued? So I think that's just the main difference between those essentially three parties that are leading the way at the moment.
And something to think about in terms of all those reactions is what do these people have to leave the island for? What is worth leaving the island for? Mm-hmm. And for like Locke, it's worth it. He has nothing to go back to. So staying on the island feels worth it to him. For Jack has less than most people to like go back to.
Well, I mean,
everybody
you know? In the caves has a good reason to be there. Sun and Jin, they're together. That's ultimately what's important to them. Hurley
well, until
does not want to go back to having money.
Until their agenda changes, until Sun is pregnant, and then their agenda changes, and it's like, and Jin is very much gung-ho in the later episodes of the season of getting off. Like, that's why he's on raft duty. You know what I mean? So like.
Right. And I think what really is, he wants to save Sun. I think it's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wants to get her home. So. Yeah,
because then she has to come back for him in time.
I like the separation of Sun and Jin is really, I don't think the show nailed that very well. Okay. Anyway, let us move on to our next question. Well, we talked about the Charlie T's already, so I don't know that we need to cover that. Let us talk about Adam and Eve and cave stuff, which we already talked about in the storm. But having just rewatched, Beyond the Sea, the episode where they like land there, and having discussed this in our little fireside chat this week, I kind of wish they had never explained Adam Eve in the cave. This is one of those questions that I kind of wish they had left alone. I don't think that I needed a literal answer to that. What do you guys think?
I would have agreed with you until I've read our next listener email.
Okay. fair enough. All right. Should we go to that?
Yes, please.
All right. Okay. We have we got some feedback from folks, and perhaps I should have said this in the comment. We got some feedback from folks that perhaps we were reading too many emails or too long of emails. And so we're trying to like pare that down a little bit. But that being said, this email from Grant, who is at heathen_king on Twitter, is one of my favorite listener emails I've ever gotten. And he is such a quality follow on Twitter. I followed him for years. You guys should consider doing it. Anyway, I've pared it down, believe it or not. This is an email from Grant about his unified theory of loss. It's our only storm email, so bear with us. I will try to read it more slowly than I read some emails sometimes. So here we go. Hello, Dave, Neil, and Joanne. I was dedicated to teasing out a grand unified theory of Lost based on a few things. There are perceived inconsistencies in how Lost handles the dead slash death and what exactly the purpose of the island is. Note, this is all about the background mythology of the show, not necessarily the character based ultimate message of community and connection. So this is Grant trying to like answer some things without saying that the answers are the most important part of what Lost is trying to do. And so then Grant in this email sort of talks about the themes. It's useful to maybe look at Damon Lindelof's shows, The Leftovers, to see what themes are of interest to him that he continued to pursue in that show. So Grant says, the most glaring reflection to me is the concept of Axis Mundi, the connection between a heaven and earth, which is the title of Leftovers season 2, episode 1. The Axis Mundi in The Leftovers seems to be this place, Jardin, Texas. For Lost, the island itself serves as an Axis Mundi, the connection between a material world and some kind of afterlife. After all, we see in season 6... Oh, we're in the storm. That's fine. Okay. After all, we see in season 6 that the Sideways world is an afterlife constructed by the island for our characters where they can gather prior to moving on. I want to note that just a little bit of research into this concept reveals that an Axis Mundi may be represented by a column of smoke. Dun, dun, dun. Direct from Wikipedia. It may have the form of a natural object, a mountain, a tree, a vine, a stalk, a column of smoke or fire, or a product of human manufacture, a staff, a tower, a ladder, a staircase, etc. Grant goes on to say, I also want to mention that several characters specifically call the monster in season 6 the Smoke Thing. We know Lindelof is an enormous fan of Alan Moore. He's adapting a version of Watchmen to a television series, after all. Moore got his start in American comics through a revival of DC's Swamp Thing. Moore is really good at a technique of everything you thought you knew about this character is wrong. Historically, which... Joanna sidebar, of course, is exactly what the beginning of what Lost does. Historically, Swamp Thing was a man named Alec Holland, transformed by some classic Silver Age science into the Swamp Thing. That's one reading of what happened to Smoke Monster, Jacob's brother, was tossed into a water cave and across the sea and was transformed into the Smoke Monster. But more, Swamp Thing was a creature who thought it was Alec Holland transformed to the Swamp Thing, but it was actually an ancient creature who absorbed Holland's memories, so it thinks it's Holland. What other creature also absorbs or read memories? Oh yeah, the Smoke Monster. We should note the importance that we have a separate dead body for the brother, one of the Adam and Eve corpses, origin shown in Across the Sea in season 6. Is it Across the Sea or Beyond the Sea? Probably Across the Sea. I got that wrong. Okay.
I think Beyond the Sea is an X-Files episode that's amazing.
It's also a great song. Bobby Darin song. Okay. I bring these three concepts to the table because I think the explanation of Lost is that the island is an Axis Mundi. The Smoke Thing is the... Oh, three concepts. I cut one concept. The Smoke Thing is the ancient demiurge ruling over this place, and the Smoke Thing thinks that it is Jacob's brother. What we know about the Smoke Monster is that it can take the form of dead people. Check. It can read their memories, minds. Check. He recites John Locke's final thoughts before death. Season 6, episode 1, LAX. What if this entity did this first to Jacob's brother because he was the first it read slash impersonated? It genuinely thought that's who he was, but he absorbs Christian, Yemi, Alex, and Locke as well. And we see hints that this possibly becoming confused about Locke near the end. In the finale, we get this exchange. Locke says, "This remind you of anything, Jack?" Jack says, "What?" Locke says, "Desmond, going down into a hole in the ground. If there was a button down there to push, we could fight together about whether or not to push it. It'd be just like old times." So that's a Smoke Monster sort of thinking it's still Locke. Jacob himself might know the truth of this. He refers to the monster as an old friend who has grown tired of my company, not as his brother. I really feel like I've been talking so long, so I probably have to stop.
You should have let me read the Swamp Thing part, because I could have done it in Dave comic book monologue speech.
I'll wrap up here. I guess there's the question of what difference does it make, whether the monster thinks it's Jacob's brother or whether it is Jacob's brother somehow transmuted. Jacob and the monster are the personifications of two halves of the island's will, one bending towards protection, the other bending towards escape. There's an extra layer of tragedy to a dispassionate metaphysical entity corrupted by a material being, but it seems like the smoke needs to be returned to the island. It can't leave, but why? It's an essential part of the island. The monster gives a face to all that darkness swirling around, as described by Jacob in the cork metaphor. Would that darkness even be there if the material world, the corpse of Jacob's brother, had been able to interface with and corrupt the light? There was a balance that needed to be restored. Jack had to reset the island to reincorporate the monster back into its bulk. And as a reward for contributing to the reset, the light slash island acted as a spiritual magnet for the souls of the 815 survivors and associated parties like Juliet, Desmond, Bend, and, Penny, in its capacity as Axis Mundi before allowing them to pass to the beyond. Thank you for reading, and I hope you like this theory, and hopefully this crackpot tinfoil makes sense. Keep the good work, and I'll see you in another life, brother. Grant. So, forgive that long email. It's a really good email. There was much more to it. Grant is fantastic. I know that Dave likes this email, so to be a total asshole about it, I'm gonna start with Neil. Neil, what do you think of Grant's theory here?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Or did you have your head down on the desk like when Dave talks too long and you and I?
It's interesting because the many versions of my track the rewatch are not quite as far as yours. So, it's almost like anytime we talk about Jacob and the Men in Black, my eyes sort of glaze over, because it feels very disconnected from where we are right now. But as a reading of the show as a whole, I do enjoy it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty much all I have to say for now.
Dave?
I really like this because it keeps the island magical, even though the series was like, here are these two brothers that represent one black and one white and are fighting over something, and really squares the circle of the mother being like, there's the light. It represents part of the light that's in every human. We need to protect it from them. They're fucking crazy. And then a human being the thing that, like, the memories of a human and the memory of that, you know, existential being, like, perverting part of the light. Like, almost like, not that it just thinks it's its brother, but it thinks it's an individual. And, like, that's what's broken in all of humanity in the first place, is we all have a part of this, like, fucking light, but we don't understand that it is all the one light. And so I love this idea that the evil force is not only man created, but is apart from the good, the light part, and is just sort of struggling because it keeps absorbing some of the most painful memories of the timeline, and becoming those people to try to tempt middle ground people. It's great because it allows you to put some Christian labels on it. It allows you to keep your idea of heaven and hell, but then also, you know, you saw a showdown between God and the devil, and you know how that turns out. So I really like it. It expands the mythology while actually, I think, explaining a lot of things.
It's interesting because, like, I think of Jacob and the Men in Black as, you know, especially in the episode where they're watching the Black Rock, which is Richard Albert's ship, sort of come towards the island. I think of them as, you know, God and the devil in the story of Job, right? Like two divine entities sort of playing dice with these human lives, and testing, like, as, you know, they're both Jacob more literally testing them, but they're both kind of testing them in a way to see who's right about humanity. Like that's one sort of story to lay over them. The other is this idea of something that keeps plaguing me as I watch The Man in Black in the later seasons, is this idea of, like, is he corporeal? Is the smoke monster corporeal? He is, but it's tricky because you can't harm him, but he can, like, move things. He can punch things. He can shoot things. He can hold things. So, like, that's my Buffy mind working, because there's this villain in Buffy, called, you know, the First, and like this idea of being corporeal or not is a big question. And so, like, when you have Jacob's brother, the Man in Black, you have a body for him that we see in the cave. There is a body for the Man in Black. He's dead. That's his body. Then it's not a question of, like, the smoke monster inhabiting a dead body and moving it about. It's taking the shape of, but taking the shape in a corporeal way, which is kind of fascinating to me. I don't know. I might be too far in my Buffy head to sort of, like.
No, I don't think so. And then that's also a power that's only allowed to him while he's separate, because when his connection to the light is opened, he's all part of.
He's vulnerable.
You know, the one. He's vulnerable because he's all part of the one force.
Yeah.
It's almost like that that state of being reminds him that he's not separate from these things. And that he's like, anyway, go ahead.
No, no. And a reason why I like Grant's theory, and I sympathize with Neil's perspective and sympathize with our Storm listeners who are like, hey, I'm just watching this show for the first time since it first aired. What the fuck are you guys talking about? But like this, you know, Terry O'Quinn for the last season of the show is playing a character who's not John Locke. But the moments in which he gets to play that character as also kind of John Locke, I think that's more rewarding to watch. You know what I mean? So I think for the smoke monster to assume some of the human personality of whatever form he's inhabiting, you know, I would much rather Terry O'Quinn do that as an actor than just can play a completely different character for his last, you know, much a long stretch of his last, episodes on the show. So, you know what I mean? All right. What other sort of Storm thoughts do we have about this episode? Are there any number instances
Oh, there are a couple number instances. I think it's like what 11:15, you 11:15.
Got a 15. Yeah.
And, eight something. There's an eight something. Anyway, but the important thing I wanted to ask is could somebody refresh me what we know about Jin? Like, do we ever figure out who that blood belongs to?
It feels like a
mid-season Lost thing to be like, oh, let's close off all the loops we can.
We get it in translation, which is his sort of like parallel episode.
They already know at this point.
We find out where the puppy comes from, where the blood comes from, and it's all like him doing the nicest version of the evil deeds that Mr. Pike has asked him to do. You know what I mean? Like,
yes, Pike Industries. That's the name of the company that we apparently learn eventually. Then I've learned is actually a real company now that does construction in New England. But we don't actually, we learn a little bit more about the company, but I thought in my mind, I was just like, I'd made up this whole Godfather persona and like secret cabal in my head, and I don't think we actually see that. If you guys reminded me correctly, we learned that he works with Widmore in some way, so he could be nefarious, but he's not one of our nefarious businessmen that actually shows up on the island.
No. Not quite.
Good to know.
Neil, how about you? Any other Storm thoughts?
No, I feel like this is another just really, really good. We're in a stretch of really good episodes, and this is just another really good one, guys.
As a way of teasing next week, I think next week's the first B-.
Really?
Oh, say this one is?
Yeah, this is not my favorite episode. Mostly because I think it does everything a disservice to only show us like half of the story. You know what I mean? Like, they're still deceiving us even through the like flashbacks. You know what I mean?
That's what they do, though. Yes. That goes back to the original question: is like, do we think this show leans too hard in misleading us? Because they do. Like, because we just talked about the episode coming up in translation where we see sort of the flip. We see sort of Jin's experience through the whole thing, and you get it's like an onion. They just keep peeling back more and more and more. I think that's actually one of the more potentially frustrating things if you're rewatching it slowly, is that season one does get into some of these like heavy misleading. I feel like that lets up as you get out of season one and into sort of season two. But yeah. I don't know. We'll see if anyone agrees with me when we get down the line.
We have 10 episodes between now and in translation, which is
right.
Crazy.
It's very slow. It feels excruciatingly slow.
Yeah.
When you know where it ends up. But I do think that there was a lot of like value of keeping the audience in the dark through that first time. And I wonder if our folks who are in the calm, maybe we could ask them at some point.
We have two whole fucking Charlie episodes before we get to the Jin episode. And as a bunch of people are complaining, we have three total. If you count the pilot as a Jack episode, which I think you kind of should, you have three Jack episodes before you get to your first Hurley episode, which is silly because Hurley episodes are the best episodes. So, you know, whatever.
That's true. But there's 23 episodes in the first season. So,
yeah, one of those is all cowboys have daddy issues, which is should have been what White Rabbit's flashback story was. But whatever. Yes. Lost is moving slow, but I'm freaking loving it because I forgot how well written and executed it is. Even if, so even like we're doing what we're doing in the storm, which is applying six seasons of knowledge to an episode that had none of that knowledge going into it, there's still enough holding it all together for me.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I feel like I've joined Dave in the dark side. Cause like I remember in the first episode and he's like, Jacob and blah, 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 blah. I was like, whoa, slow down, buddy. Calm down. Let's just like make this more friendly. And then I watched
eventually
all
we're
of
all
Lost,
corrupted.
And I was like, and the, is the smoke monster corporeal or is it not? I have a lot of questions about it. So yeah.
Yes. Welcome. Welcome. I'm a man of science who will make men of faith.
But I think like what we can say in The Storm is that in terms of Charlie episodes, the show learned very quickly that Charlie episodes are, with the exception of the last Charlie episodes are hard to land. And that's eventually why they were like, first they were like,
because they're
don't
just
know
all about drugs.
We were like, we don't know what to do with Charlie. And then they were like, okay, we figured out what to do with Charlie. It's kill him. It's going to be great. You're going to love it. But then we're done until the last season. So, yeah.
Well, next week we're going to get to, you know, watch Rockstar get addicted to drugs. Like,
can I tell you why it's going to be better, though?
Why is it going to be better?
Because we have a special guest, a rock star in her own right. It's Buffering co-host, musician, Jenny Owen Youngs, everybody. I'm really excited.
Yay! She's going to talk about who was the real center of Drive Shack.
I want her to like musically break down Drive Shack, tell me like why it's a hit or not. So
could she also complete the sentence to me where Charlie says, I sing the chorus because then, and then his brother cuts him off and he's like, it won't ever happen again. Like musically, why does the bassist sing the chorus? Like, did they need two different vocal sounds?
I'm writing
some sort of Oasis. Is this some sort of Oasis like reference that I'm not getting?
I'm writing it down. Why?
Go deep on the Oasis stuff.
Why does Charlie sing the chorus
sing
of
the
you
chorus
all everybody?
Of you all everybody. Have I ever told you about the fact that I've watched multiple Oasis documentaries on YouTube?
No. This is interesting because I know like virtually nothing about him.
Yeah, same.
Let's talk about it next week, everybody. It'll be great.
All right. Well, until then, where can people find more of your work around the internet? Let's start with Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get me on Twitter at Rejects. You can get me at filmschoolrejects.com where I'm actually writing things this week. We got big list of the 50 best comedy movies ever dropping. It's going to be fun. And happy to announce that stormofspoilers.com, which is our old URL, is now redirecting to a new fancy website that you should go check out.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Is there another URL that maybe
if you wanted to
have a Game of Thrones reference?
If you wanted to skip to the actual new URL, it's stormpodcast.com. So go check it out.
What about a childish annoying thing to do.com?
Yeah, like all of them.
What about familiarwithmylon.com?
Journalism died the day the internet was born.com.
Great what pages of last books.com.
Last pages of great books.com.
That pages of great books.com.
That one was from Dan Weiss himself.
Yeah, we're going to troll those guys until, I don't know. Ever. Forever. Until we control them about Star Wars, I guess. Joanna, where can people find more of your work online?
You can find me at vanityfair.com. You follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I am watching the show Big Little Lies with my pal Richard Lawson on the podcast Still Watching.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You could find me on another podcast called Fighting in the War Room. You could find me on Twitter at DA70, and you could find my writings at Thrillist.com and Polygon.com. And this new podcast, I feel, I haven't explained that it's very dangerous if you fall down. So there's nothing more I could wish for you than to stay upright until we speak next. Don't fall down, 2019.